Welcome to Amazon Legends, where we have real stories about making it big on Amazon. Our guests are CEOs of large companies and entrepreneurs who became power sellers. Also providers specializing in helping sellers, aggregators that acquire sellers, and former Amazonians will give us an insight from behind the scenes. Here is your host, Nick Urison.
Welcome to another episode of Amazon Legends. My next guest today has been in performance marketing for over two decades, working for major brands, including eBay and Commission Junction. And for those who have been around, you know about Commission Junction. They've been there, you know, created the whole, today's what they call influencer marketing, but it's really affiliate marketing. So I was a customer myself. And so he's been in that space working for these giants. Today, he is the CEO and founder of Round Barn Labs, which is a 10-year-old company. They are in performance marketing as a performance marketing agency. And when he's not working, he lives in Austin. So he likes exploring Austin, tennis, and his two kids. 1-year-old and a 3-year-old. So with that, everybody, meet my guest, Ty DeGrange. Welcome to the show, Ty.
Hey, everyone. Hey, Nick. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure. Thanks for it's going to be a good discussion.
Yes. So, you know, Commission Junction takes me back many, many years because I remember this was year 2008. And if you remember those days, there was a financial meltdown approaching. In fact, we didn't even know what was happening at the time. So it was around those days that I was getting ready to launch my new operation. And we were selling an e-commerce company, selling fragrances and healthcare products, health and beauty products. And I was attacking everything. I thought, okay, you know, do this, do that, do that. Amazon was not really part of it, but those days it was called data feed marketing. And of course, Commission Junction was one of those, but it was too expensive. It was cost prohibitive for me to really join.
Yeah. CJ is fascinating. You know, they're still a very viable network. I think they just recently announced a new CEO. They're actually part of Publicis now, so they're plugged into a great network of agencies and brands that are looking to do multi-channel performance marketing. And I think for the time that I was there and the time period you were essentially looking to plug in about the time that I was there, which was probably, you know, peak that era of CJ and that era of affiliate marketing. They're still a very good platform, a lot of smart people there. But affiliate is fascinating because in some ways you get to tap into aspects of multi-channel marketing so much so that it's not even really, I think, a channel. It's more of a mechanism to say, hey, I'm willing to pay out for valued actions. And so CJ provides that tracking and that payment and some insights for particular partners that they work with.
Yeah, I mean, you see, people kind of don't really, I don't think they understand the whole role of influencers today or affiliates those days. So it's just like having a product that, let's say, Walmart decides to put on the shelf. Walmart is not going to do anything to market it. Walmart is simply an outlet for the end user to have access to your product. And of course, conveniently, because they have many, many stores. When you go online, it's the same situation. So affiliates are simply there to provide access to their audiences. But you really have to build up your marketing. You have to build up that awareness. Because if I remember right, affiliates those days, I mean, so many videos, they have a way of checking, okay, which offering pays me the most money? I mean, to this day, it's still the same. Which offering pays me the most money? What is their conversion rate? what is their average ticket and all those things. So if you don't have those mechanics in place, then obviously affiliates won't find it attractive enough to carry you. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, it's a great call out. I mean, on one hand, you have the platforms that are really providing the visibility and the tracking and the payments. And as I mentioned, some insights, but the affiliates, the influencers, the partners, the publishers, the creators, these are all words used to describe a very similar mechanism, are doing the lion's share of the work along with the everyone's doing the work, right? It's a shared marketplace. But to your point, if you're not actively managing the program to make sure your offer stands out, to make sure your compensation is well received and understood and aligns with the economics, you're absolutely right that the affiliates are going to hunt down the offer that's most compelling. And they're looking at a combination of variables, and they're very, you know, reasonably scientific around it because they have skin in the game. They're not necessarily always getting paid out flat fees up front, like a lot of other marketing. They're saying, hey, I'm willing to put some effort in to earn a cost per lead, cost per call, cost per purchase. And so they'll do some homework and analysis and even run live traffic to say, could this net out for me based on conversion rate, brand, AOV, other potential compensation levers and content levers that the advertiser is giving me. So I think you're absolutely on the right track there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So today's conversation is all about using influencers, using, in other words, what you do well is paying people for performance. So how do you put a plan like that in place, whether it's influencers, affiliates, Amazon associates, or, you know, whatever the case may be. So we're going to cover this in terms of the real hands on aspects of the relationship and getting that relationship to pay off. So we'll discuss the relationship and managing the relationship metrics and everything else. So it's a conversation I'm looking forward to because there is a lot of influencer marketing stuff going on out there. But really, everybody has some kind of a horse to bet on, so to speak. Hearing from the expert is something I'm looking forward to. So let's jump right into this. So where do we start? What is your approach to this?
Yeah, I'm just going to kind of riff off your comment around influencer and talk a little bit about how we think about setting it up and thinking about it and get context to the audience. So, you know, ultimately, we're really looking for the most valuable ROI out there, right? Regardless of where that is. We've run nearly every channel under the sun you can think of. And what we're seeing, right, when brands are talking about themselves versus having others, influencers, reviews, maybe mini celebrities or larger celebrities talk about them, it performs better. It's just shown and proven out in the data. Now, some brands, you know, are going to be able to cut through the audience. You see Super Bowl ads where brands are able to do that. Maybe they don't need as much of a influencer or a, you know, varying types of influencers, right? Down to, you know, someone who's already a customer that might want to share with a few friends to, you know, a micro or nano influencer to a medium size to a macro to a celebrity. And I think the mechanics of what happens with affiliates and publishers is very similar, right? They're either getting paid a flat fee, they're getting paid a gift. But oftentimes what we try to do and we do well is really minimize the flat fees as much as possible within reason and paying out on, you know, performance basis. So it's something that, you know, if you take a step back and think about the trends and macro things that are happening to impact this, right? Brands don't have as much control as they used to as time goes by. People don't trust as much as they used to, right? And so to have third parties, influencers, genuine authenticity, you've seen this rise of user-generated content on social, all across organic, paid, et cetera. I think it's because of this macro trend. And so there's been a big rush to figure out influencers, to your point. And we set this up, you know, through a number of ways, right? We can do this. We want to say, okay, we're going to go after affiliates for you. We're going to think about blogs, review sites, influencers on various social platforms. know, a good example on Meta Quest, YouTube was really powerful. You know, we had people, you see it all the time with Apple, right? There's YouTube is a very powerful lever to consider to work with influencers and say, hey, try out our product. We're going to send it out to you. Here's some of the terms of the deal. Here's how we're going to structure payout. And ideally, there's proper disclosures in place. We go through that process with them, right? We make sure that they're letting folks know that they're going to be, this is an ad. The FTC has really increased scrutiny and put out new standards around this just in the last year. So it's really important that you're either doing this or you're collaborating with someone that can help guide you on these, because the new standards basically say everyone needs to abide. Everyone needs to disclose and be responsible. The agency, the brand, and the influencer are on the hook, according to the FTC.
Oh, so tell me about that. I don't know. This is about that. What's it called? The 243 exemption? Is that what you're talking about?
So the new FTC guidelines, they came out almost a year ago. I believe if I go back, I believe it was close to April of last year. I'll have to look back. I've written about it on my blog, The Flywheel, which is on Beehive. We talk about it in detail, and we talk about it on our pod as well. But basically, the laws already share that if you're an influencer, you need to disclose that using hashtag ad or paid promotion when you're getting a compensation, a gift or a compensation from an advertiser, right? Nothing new there. What changed is they're saying not only is the influencer on the hook and the advertiser, but the third party's coordinating that like an agency is. And it also kind of raises the question on network. I don't have a legal counsel on for you on that yet, but all parties are really on the hook, according to the FTC. The second piece is that it really makes more specific what you can say and you can't say. And I'm happy to share kind of the more details on this legal, you know, some of the ruling and counsel around this from our industry that would be really helpful for the audience. But it makes it more specific. Makes it more comprehensive, gives them more authority to go after more people if there's a violation.
So there is this, I remember one of my closest friends is an attorney. So he told me something a long time ago. He said, never offer a guarantee. Do not use the word guarantee. So that is always something that he said, stay away from it because that's dangerous. And as yet today, everybody offers guarantees, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? It's the dance between marketing and legal is always a fun one, an interesting one, where legal, the secret sauce is to really get in lockstep, in alignment with your legal team and working from the same metrics, hopefully, so that everybody's on the same page, because it can get super restrictive. Obviously, there are certain rules that are just you can't get around, but you absolutely want to have a good working relationship with your legal team to make sure that you can kind of be able to put out messages that are going to perform well on marketing, but not get anybody in trouble legally.
Yeah. So as far as working with influencers, so give us your take on this. How does a company approach using performance marketing?
Yeah, I think in my view, I typically like to see, you know, certainly post product market fit, certainly some dedicated budget around it, you know, some willingness to test and learn in the channel. I think certain signals you're going to want to look for is if they've stood up paid search, if they've stood up paid social, that's a really good indication. The more mature these channels are, the better. Kind of gives a good baseline, because you don't want to go to market with something that influencers are not going to want to pick up. You know, a good example is there's an opportunity to gift a ton in influencer marketing to a point where if your product is good, if it's well reviewed, if it's high quality, you're going to have a lot of existing customers that are probably willing to sign up to be an ambassador or influencer of sorts. You're going to have people that are, you know, essentially lining up to promote it. So those are all things that you want to look for. That retention rate is really valuable. That AOV and lifetime value is really valuable. So once you have those standards kind of lined up, you're going to want to look at a tracking mechanism. We'll talk about this more a little bit later, but utilizing something like a CGA, like we talked about, something like an Impact. Aspire is a good one in the influencer community. Impact's done a lot recently. They've acquired companies and they have a creator product where they can track influencers quite well. Social Snowball is one I like as well. They're doing a lot of innovative things to tap into your existing customers to make it a little easier for them to promote, as opposed to try to seek out all these influencers from the outside. And then once you have that, it really becomes a recruitment, a volume game, but also a quality game where you have to recruit, a certain number, make sure they're in the program, tracked, engaged. We want to get them live with links. We want to get them trying product and giving feedback. We want to have agreements in place with them so they know kind of what they can and can't do. Ideally, there's a nice medium where the partner really feels they can come from their voice. They can speak candidly and excitedly about a product, but obviously do so in a way that's, reasonably on brand. Really, authenticity has become, it's overstated probably. But I think that's what really jumps out in terms of what performs best. And users are really savvy. They see when an influencer is maybe overly scripted or overly fake, and they can smell it out. And so I think, where there's not perfect polish or there's some maybe mild errors, some of these do surprisingly well from a performance perspective. So those are some big observations, kind of like, how do you think about getting started? And we can certainly go into other details as well.
Yeah, I had an influencer on the podcast, actually twice now, because he was on about almost 2 years ago, a year and a bit. And we brought him back to see, because influencer space is changing. There's a lot of things going on. And both occasions, he said the same thing. The number one quality you're looking for in an influencer is the passion he or she has for your product. And that's what you just confirmed. So it's the authenticity. It's that scripted promotion. People are not buying it anymore. They want that spoken from the heart, like a mother, a stay-at-home mom talking about a baby product. Is a big deal. But one thing that you mentioned that is actually a pretty good idea, recruiting your current customers as influencers. First of all, you wouldn't pay them anything, and they bought the product and they probably have an opinion. And I was just thinking, if you go back and look at your reviews, those who posted positive review, they would be the perfect candidates, right? Because they probably also posted some videos and things like that. So they would be the perfect influencers, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think of it like you kind of have a diverse portfolio approach, right? You've got these customers, positive reviewers. You can gift, you can get some secured posts from that. That's kind of like your, bit of an incubator. Maybe some of those graduate into your next stage. Then you have a slice of influencer where, they're falling into a little bit higher follower count. But as you said, that engagement rate is more important. That comments, the excitement and passion of their followers. Those might start to get into the range of, okay, they're willing to utilize an affiliate link to get paid on performance basis. Maybe some of them start to justify doing some small flat fees to say, hey, $500 will get you X number of posts. It's not going to break the bank, but you're moving up. And then I think sometimes you have a slice of influencers where, hey, this is a sizable follower count. Maybe we start to get north of 100,000. I have my like list of definitions of like nano and, over a certain size means they're a macro influencer, et cetera. Maybe you're not getting in the million followers yet, but then you're talking about definite flat fee, probably more, stringent agreements. And then that balanced portfolio is really important. And then you can kind of play with the mix. You might realize, okay, we overspent a little bit on paid. Maybe we want to reel back. Or, hey, we introduced paid here. It didn't nail it on the first one. But just like any marketing, it takes some time. Sometimes you can get the second time they post, the third time they post is surprisingly can perform much better than the first one because you're kind of warming up that audience. So those are some things to think about when you're thinking about kind of like dividing and conquering and what types of partner influencers to recruit.
Yeah. I mean, it's the approach where you are paying somebody a flat fee because they have a high number of followers. I mean, they may have a large group of people follow them, but that doesn't mean that they're going to be successful with your product, right? So you want to test and see what they can accomplish.
Exactly. And I think to that point is it's a huge piece. It's very important, right? Whenever we're suggesting a partner or an influencer affiliate, we've got a lot of historical data to lean on to say, hey, this type of partner performs really well with this type of brand and vice versa. And so we're using a lot of historical data. We're using a lot of customer, you know, advertiser fed data. We're looking at existing data in platform. And then we're kind of making determinations based on that to say, hey, this is likely to perform. And a very high percentage of the time, we're talking north of 80%. I mean, we're getting ROI on our spend, period. So that's the goal. It's not to do branded placements that don't get anything. I think you make a great point. I would also say there's an ancillary benefit, maybe a mild pivot here, but we can get a whitelist agreement. If you can get a partner to say, hey, you know what? For X amount, I'll give you rights to this great review to distribute across your paid channels. This can really perform well, and it kind of really ties together one of our reasons for being, which is getting really amplifying that trust element. People want to see and trust you. And if they see an influencer that's got some credibility, or you know, CNN or Wirecutter given a good review, and then you get the rights to port that into your paid social ads, it's a great kind of arsenal in your repertoire to complement your branded content, your video, your user generated content. So that whitelisting strategy is really important.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about different aspects of performance marketing, because your approach is not just influencer marketing, so to speak, but performance marketing. So there are networks. These are not necessary, because when you say influencer, I'm just picturing an individual. Like I said, you know, a stay-at-home mom or some Instagram whiz kid, or that's what I'm picturing. But when you say performance marketing and certain blogs and blah, blah, so that's a whole different operation. Nevertheless, it's still under performance marketing. So for our listeners, describe to us the landscape for performance marketing. Who are the players? And share with us some tips in working with these.
Yeah, totally. So outside of affiliate influencer, you obviously have your paid search, your paid social, your SEO, a lot of channels out there. You have programmatic. And then the affiliate world, as I shared earlier, there's a lot of like those elements kind of existing within affiliate. And what I would say within affiliate ecosystem and partner ecosystem is you have media houses, you know, Meredith.dash, PNC, Stack Commerce. They might have, you know, dozens, hundreds of partner sites underneath them that are very high quality, like Rolling Stone, GQ, Better Homes and Garden, BobVila.com. These are sites that can do write-ups. It's not just a block banner ad that gets, you know, people get blinded by. It's integration and content within those sites that people are reviewing. People Magazine, Time Magazine, all of those digital properties are accessible through what is kind of considered partner marketing or affiliate marketing within this ecosystem. So those are some opportunities. Then also you've got, you know, sub-affiliate networks. You've got Skimlinks, Sojourn. They have even a more powerful list of sites that you can reach out to work with. You have Coupon and Deal, you know, for especially for like consumer electronics. Slick Deals is one of the highest traffic sites out there. You obviously got to be managing your deal promotional schedule as you would a brand and make sure it falls into your profit goals and you're not cannibalizing too much. But there's a lot of good opportunity to be featured on deal and discount sites. There's also gated sites. Sites where you have to be a member. They might have some for college students. You require a college URL. You might have some for Bank of America employees that can log in and get specific perks for being an employee. Then you've got loyalty, whole new vertical. You've got American Express, Rakuten Rewards, You Promise, where maybe you allocate, moms like to allocate spend towards their college savings for their kid. So there's a lot of things out there that people don't really associate or think about, and a surprisingly high number of people that will consider using one of these partners as part of their buying journey online or part of their discovery journey.
Those big ones like American Express and others, how do you get into those big organizations? Do they have the same thing in common in terms of getting into them, or each one is different?
The networks have some similarities in terms of their partner discovery technology and in terms of their how to connect with partners. Partners typically can apply. You know, if you're Nike, you can receive applications and someone on your team or an agency can review and say, I approve Amex and I disapprove the other partner. What often is the differentiator is someone with some affiliate or influencer marketing experience can, you know, come in and either be in-house and help you navigate that process, or an agency more readily is a good often way to navigate that to say, okay, how do I make sense? How do I have a conversation with Amex? It's easy. Some of them work with third parties, some of them work with brokers. So it's a very relationship-based business. There's, you know, quarterly at least trade shows that the most of the key players are attending. So if you have someone that's attending those regularly on your behalf to kind of evangelize and say, hey, we'd like to work with you, those can help. We have a very extensive database on our end, just as an example, where we kind of know who that main contact is. We've seen them at a recent show, we've integrated them with the brand already. So it's usually a human element versus a programmatic element in some of these other channels. When you're getting on Google, when you're getting on Meta, you don't need to necessarily email with a human being to arrange that. Surprisingly, with affiliate, there's some programmatic, but there's a lot of human elements still involved. So having someone on your behalf to kind of, you know, broker and negotiate that is often needed.
So the first place that comes to mind to be able to start something like that is LinkedIn, I guess, right? Because you're saying that you just need to reach out, find the right person, and it's not a system-driven approach. So if you find out who is the person in charge on LinkedIn and initiate a contact and then see where it goes, what do you say to that?
Yeah, yes, for sure, possible, and it can help move things along. But scalability wise, it can be tough. That's where kind of our reason for supporting and helping brands kind of get the attention through tech, through one to many messages, through, you know, if we have to nudge someone on LinkedIn, that helps. But we use everything from email to CRM to a conference for our system to recruit partners. You know, and then some of that can be done by getting people attention on social like that, but it's kind of by any means necessary. So it's a bit of herding cats exercises at times.
So I'm sure agencies have those relationships, so they can recommend. They kind of marry the advertiser with the right kind of platform based on what fits the best and then what the requirements are and things like that, right?
Exactly. The best affiliate marketers are really phenomenal matchmakers, and they're doing it in a very, you know, hey, how do we get the best performance out of it way? Not just relationships, but data and relationships.
I mean, once you have the deal, then obviously it's the execution is everything, right? So execution means right kind of content, right kind of tracking in terms of what's working, what's not working. And so it's not
Yeah.
something you want to do on your own. So let's talk about the Amazon program because they have something new. They call it the Creator Program, right? Not influencer, but creator. So Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazon's got one of the most storied histories in affiliate, with Associates being massive, and then recently coming out with Creator. They're trying to tap into the influencer space, and a lot of influencers are flocking to it. A lot of brands are wanting to take advantage of it. It's one of the most widely promoted brands. There's so many SKUs, there's so much velocity through it. It's very attractive for affiliates and creators in this case to really consider. They've thrown a lot of technology at it to make sure that they're supporting creators and doing it right. So it's definitely grown. It's definitely gained a lot of attention. It's definitely I think there's also a number of challenges that comes with it, where certain other partners are kind of coming in and complementing it as well.
Yeah. So what is a good idea? Because there is this split between micro influencers versus the large ones. So what is your take on bringing them on board? Who is a better deal and in the for the brand to benefit from?
Yeah, we've gotten really positive response from a performance and also just a subjective reaction from the brand around a lot of these nano and micro influencers that might have less follower count, but just very much exude like, hey, genuinely care about this product. This isn't like a full-time job for me where I have an army of PR people helping me. The micro, the nano has been very attractive. It can be some challenge around kind of the scalability and the organization of them, but again, that's one of the things that we can help support with. But the brands, from a performance and a subjectivity perspective, are really responding positively to getting a good volume of quality, authentic partners that are really not necessarily massive. We're talking about like sub 50,000 followers, sometimes even less, sometimes sub 10,000. And you have to balance that with the traffic volume, revenue volume you're going to get from those. But I've seen examples where influencers can be very high ROI. They're not going to be as high ROI as your highest ROI performance marketing channels, but as part of the mix, I've seen them get definitely a number of them getting definitely a return on investment and ROI.
Well, I mean, this is interesting. So, influencer marketing programs rank much lower on the ROI scale compared to your other marketing programs. But I would have thought that the reason why people choose influencers is because of the ROI, because of their wider reach. So, why is it not as favorable?
Yeah, I think it's hard to say, on a whole that it's not as favorable. I think that what happens is it's very dependent upon the channel. We're talking about YouTube, Meta, TikTok, et cetera. There's so many channels and there's so many brands and so many different situations. So I don't want to say like it's not as favorable. I would say if you're talking about like Meta is just a machine from a performance marketing perspective. Google, especially with, some intent-based search, very hard to beat from a pure performance marketing perspective, right? If you introduce some of the affiliate elements of like deal and loyalty where there's intent, but then you kind of mix in content, the ROI there can be phenomenal. Affiliate can have one of the best ROIs and efficiencies in CAC I've seen. If you're talking about comparing it to those outside of that, again, it's a bit of a blanket statement, but I think it can compete. But it has to be really well set up and structured the right way. You got to have managed URL, you got to have your UTM set up properly, you've got to have maybe a unique code to help make sure you're tracking properly. It's not as attributable as Google search, just as an example. I think people get that.
Yeah.
And I think again, people can lose their shirt on influencer if they're not doing it the right way, and maybe they're putting too much stock in those big names and not as much of that excitement, passion for your product, et cetera, like we talked about, that engagement rate. And some just don't convert as well. Some of that's attribution, but some of that's more of a, you're more getting into the awareness consideration part of the funnel versus the conversion part of the funnel. It still plays a role. And that's that, then you get into the difficult part of the attribution process. But, we counsel clients all the time on, hey, what kind of attribution window makes sense? How do we set these up the right way? You are getting the best ROI possible on influencer. So if we do influencer, we tend to get ROI, right? We tend to get efficiency. But I think compared to those really most efficient channels, it's usually not going to be your, hey, I got the best ROI, I got the best CPA of all my other channels. Ideally, it still plays a part. It still contributes.
I have a question for my listeners. Are you experiencing cash flow challenges with your Amazon business? Well, silly question. Who is not, right? So let me introduce you to Viably, a unique solution tailored for Amazon sellers and e-commerce enterprises. By connecting your Seller Central or Shopify account, you can promptly access funding along with a variety of financial tools, all for a flat fee. It's as simple as that. And for my listeners, they are offering an extra $1,500 in funding for eligible applications. Start your quick and easy application today at runviably.com/legends. And that's runviably.com/legends. Okay, so as far as the ROI, so I heard you mention improving the tracking, improving the coding. So tell us a little bit about that. What does that entail?
Yeah, I would say it's a great question. So making sure that, if you're utilizing an impact or a CJ for your, network-based tracking, really making sure that they're set up there, they have that appropriate link. In addition to that, you want to go through a proper, Google UTM builder, make sure that aligns with your internal tracking so you can define each of those parameters appropriately. There's ways to do that through Google URL Builder. There's ways to get advice from your team and from an agency around that. Those are two really big ones. It sounds very simple, but a lot of times it's not being done properly. There's ways to go into a CJ or an impact and kind of go through the URL building process with a partner that's new or even a mature partner to say, okay, here are the links. These links are dedicated to you. A lot of the networks are now enabling you to say, okay, you're going to use this code and it's X number of uses or it's one time use. There's ways to do it so that other partners are not getting credit. If I'm influencer, 123 in LA and I get a code, we don't want influencer ABC in Dallas to use that code and get credit for their attributed code. So there's ways to set that up from a network, a Google UTM, and a vanity and a code perspective that all really help give you the best fidelity there. Aside from that, I think just that should cover you at a macro level, but there's other things from a, with affiliate, are you tracking off of API, Pixel, or Batch, really the top three tracking methodologies? And it's wild how often you're not getting enough tracking fidelity. We recommend Moonpole. They're a really good third party that does a great job with tracking and validating affiliate traffic. And they can run through any, a lot of different URLs, influencer-based traffic too, to make sure that from the entire spring, are we losing tracking at any given point? And they've done a lot of thought around cookies, first-party cookies, third-party deprecation. Fortunately, a lot of affiliate does rely on first-party cookies, but some of it does rely on third, which we know has gone away for many and is going away for all by the end of this year. So it's starting to go away as we speak. So it's really important to kind of have those things covered and checked to make sure that you're tracking as effectively as you can.
So obviously, you're talking about websites. So using these influencers or affiliates on your website. When it comes to Amazon, you can't use any of these things, right? You would have to go by what Amazon provides, which is the attribution tags, right?
Correct. And again, maybe it's a good segue. You've got, various offerings that Amazon has put out from an associate and creator performance, but maybe it's a segue into the opportunity with Levanta. They've done a very good job to introduce a software and a way to track Amazon ASINs, Amazon seller activity with third-party traffic like an influencer and affiliate. And so we're seeing it with some of our brands. We're seeing it with a lot of interest from people. They're growing very quickly. They're doing a great job. They come out of the affiliate space. They understand the people and the players and the and how it all fits together. It's a great complement to an Impact or a CJ. I think it's a good complement to an influencer network like an Aspire or a Social Snowball. And they're basically letting you drive traffic directly to those ASINs and have the full visibility. They're also really enabling that kickback that Amazon's doing. So they're really, Amazon's really incentivizing that 10% kickback for third-party traffic into those ASINs and those seller URLs. So it's kind of an awesome opportunity for e-com brands that are on Amazon and selling well to really tap into affiliate and influencer in a way that didn't really make as much sense before.
You mentioned Levant, right? So tell us about, so this is a separate company, obviously, like CJ, and it's designed for influencers to be, I guess, tracked to drive business to Amazon listings.
Yeah, Levant has been around for not that long. I think they built and sold a software company to acquisition, and then they recently launched Levanta, I want to say maybe barely 2 years ago. They're growing, they're hiring, they're making it easy for brands to plug in that are Amazon sellers to send affiliate and influencer traffic to Amazon pages and ASINs. It's much more controllable, attributable. It's not as much of a black box as I think we've seen from, you don't have as many levers available to you with associates program. A lot of times you're limited there, and it's really Amazon based brand. Whereas this is really opening up any seller to really drive traffic directly using Levanta's technology.
Yeah. So my standard question for using influencers in terms of tracking is, when you work with an influencer, how do you drive the traffic to your Amazon listing? Do you drive it directly? So do you share your product listing page URL or in another way? So in your opinion, what is the right way to do it?
Yeah, typical use case for most brands using something like a Levanta is probably to look at the driving traffic to the specific product listing that you're referencing. Yeah, the influencer can kind of tell a story or link in various ways to, like, this is the product, this is why I used it, this is why it's great. And that's been kind of the most frequent use case that I've seen. I imagine there's probably sometimes other use cases where they're not going directly to the product page, which are doable, but I think it's primarily product detail page.
So I'm glad you mentioned that, because I want to dig into that a little bit. So as you know, on Amazon, metrics are everything. So the algorithms are looking at all these indicators for a product as well as the seller, and then they're making decisions. And the one of the most important metrics is the conversion rate. So when you work with influencers, you really have no idea what they can do. They may do very little, they may do great. But how about those influencers that drive a lot of traffic, but not necessarily orders? So now you have a situation where your conversion rate is going to take a huge hit if you're driving those visitors directly to the product detail page. So that's where I am a little bit cautious about driving traffic directly to product listing page from external sources, influencer or otherwise, even Google Ads. So, what is your take on this?
Yeah, it's a huge call out. So this is a huge issue. This is a huge consideration in affiliate marketing as well as it is an influencer. We spent a ton of time investing, looking at ways to make sure our landing page and the user experience is really optimal to convert. So you're hitting on something that's really important. It's a lot of affiliate and influencer engagements that definitely require some warm up, some offer page, some, maybe it's a listicle, or these have become a really important piece of the affiliate influencer puzzle, which I'm glad you brought up. So depending on the situation and the level of how much that traffic is warmed up, you do want to strongly consider having some kind of a, is it a review page? Is it a listicle where that person is describing in detail something more long form? Maybe it's a higher ticket item. So depending on the situation, sometimes it might be almost category like in behavior. We've given a lot of thought internally around, especially in e-com, the various types of pages that one might want to have to really optimize for conversion. And so that's applicable on the affiliate side when you're sending direct to consumer to the site. That's applicable in this scenario where we're talking more about, third-party traffic going to an Amazon page. So we got to consider both. And there's definitely times where you don't go straight to product detail. There's definitely times when you want to have a little bit more of a warm up. I've seen definitely both work. But in some cases, you're definitely going to want a, you're kind of removing a lot of the other ancillary factors and really guiding them through that funnel process, sometimes a very required piece of the step.
Yeah. So what is the determining factor to send direct to the product detail page or not?
I think it's tough to fully say. It's like an if-then statement. We'll often, model out our hypotheses, most things we test and experiment. And, I think if we can see a model where our conversion rate is high enough estimated from that PDP, to net out for the investment and for the experiment and for the test, then we probably would opt for the product detail page. We'll run a lot of, okay, historical data. What do they have internally? I think where there's perhaps less trust going through the system, less trust with the influencer, then we might need to have kind of more of a building of that trust through the landing page. I've seen cases where an influencer can have so much trust and kind of their post almost becomes a landing page in itself in terms of explaining away those concerns and pumping up the psych factor, as Reforge will talk about, that you don't necessarily need to have that intermediate or that kind of warm-up page or that review page or that, explanation of the product in more detail. So it comes a bit of a math and science problem in terms of an estimate, but we can also make adjustments, right? You have to sometimes. And so if we are seeing that it's not converting, the beauty of affiliate and influencer by an extension is you get to kind of negotiate with the partner as the campaign's going to say, hey, we've had an X amount of time, we're at stat sig, we're not seeing conversion as healthy as we thought. Let's try something new. So do we need to add confidence builders? Do we need to add trust symbols? Do we need to maybe come up with a co-branded page? That's something that's really powerful for influencers of a sizable, trust level to say, hey, trust symbol and XYZ brand have partnered together, and that's going to give you even more confidence to say this is something worth pursuing.
Yeah. What you mentioned is so key. So there's quite a few. You're very soft spoken. You deliver a lot of very valuable pieces of information. But yeah, I want to really emphasize these things, because there's quite a few things I picked up from everything you said. So first of all, do not go hiring 10 different influencers all at the same time. Test one at a time, right? So that's key, because you want to know what they're going to bring to the table. The second thing that I heard is you have to test. You have to test. In order to test, you have to have historical data about your page performance, your product detail page performance, before the influencer comes on board and after the influencer comes on board, so that you can see how that's impacting your conversion rates. So between those two, bringing one at a time and testing before you go all out is important for two reasons. First, you get a sense of what's going on. Second, when you are ready to scale, bring another influencer and another influencer. And so it's going to multiply, right? So you now have a playbook, so to speak, of what to do and what to look for. And then you start to set your benchmarks around these influencers of how you want them to perform. And then also, these playbooks are important, not about knowing what to do in a new situation. They are also important in situations where things don't work. So it's almost like creating one of those flowcharts. Like, if this happens, do this. If this happens, do that. So that's what the real playbook is about. So what you mentioned about, you know, if it doesn't perform the way you expect, then maybe co-branded page, maybe this, maybe that. So there's so much you delivered. I had to, like, you know, bring it back up because it's so valuable. I want to conclude with this thing and tell me what you think. So there's, again, two controversial approaches to bringing affiliates direct to your product detail page, if we go that route. One is using the Amazon attribution tags. The other, so of course, with that, you get to have that extra brand referral bonus, plus you are able to track which affiliate. You can set up different tags for each influencer, and then you can see. The other one is don't use attribution tags. Get people to use the Amazon Associates program, because then that doesn't interfere with conversion. Then you can do it all day long. But then you don't have the data in terms of what the influencer is doing. The influencer has the data. They are already making their money. You don't even get to see it. It just shows up as traffic coming to your product detail page. So tell me, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I would honestly lean towards, I think this kind of underscores the opportunity with Levanta to get more visibility. They are a third-party software, but they've done an amazing job of working with Amazon to make sure they get enough data to really, I think, give you more data and insights and control to really make affiliate influencer make more sense for sending to Amazon. You're just going to see more insights, more data, more information that you can react on. You made a great point that, you know, Associates is great. You know, it's sizable to volume, but I think, you know, my experience seems like it makes a lot of sense for Amazon-based products. Not to say you can't, you know, it can't work, but I'm excited about what Levanta is offering, because it just seems like it's so much more brand-centric in terms of like what they typically expect from a platform. Amazon's great for advertising. Don't get me wrong. Across the ecosystem, you've talked to a ton of guests that tout that, from the DSP to all the ad units to the benefits are immense. But from an affiliate perspective, I think something is, Levanta has unlocked something important where it kind of seems to make more sense with this channel from a product tracking and kind of customer matchup.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're not related to Levanta, right? So you just happen to be, yeah. So I'm happy to say Levanta will be on the show soon. I'm looking forward to that one. And they'll be on the show soon. We now record this at the end of February 2024. And I think we have a recording scheduled in a couple of weeks or so, and then it will air probably a few weeks after that. So, for those who are looking for this, it will be a good show. Okay, so let's now get to know you a little bit, Ty. So we talked all about performance marketing, influencer tags, this, that, the other. But who is Ty DeGrange? Tell us about yourself. But what I'm interested in is not your resume. It's who you are as a person and how you got to be here. So give us your where did you grow up and what was it like growing up as a kid in terms of what you do today? When was that first starting to show signs?
Thank you. I grew up in Northern California, a town about an hour north of San Francisco. I was fortunate because my grandfather and grandfather started a summer camp in Dude Ranch for kids, and so a lot of they'd bring kids up from San Francisco to learn how to be, cowboy or cowgirl and get the life of the farm. And that's how my mom and my uncle grew up. And that's how my sister and I grew up. And my dad was a real cowboy. He was a horse trainer. Met my mom at the summer camp, and they fell in love, and then they separated and got disconnected, lived their lives, and then and older, they reconnected at a horse event, of course. I think my mom was judging. My dad reached over, picked her up, gave her a big kiss, and rode off into the sunset. Just yeah, it's a very, very amazing upbringing, a good, close-knit family, a great community. I was able to meet so many lovely people through the summer camp growing up, and got exposed to riding horses and taking care of animals and working on a ranch. And I think there's a, discipline and work ethic that's appreciated. Hard work was always rewarded. I wasn't really, I joke with people I was raised to be a cowboy, but ended up in performance marketing. It's very different, obviously. But I'm finding myself looking back to my dad's sage words of wisdom, which I've written about on my blog and stuff. Like, he had some zingers that are really true to this day. And so it was an informative way to grow up. It led me to, great college experience and great friends. And I enjoyed competing at sport, in baseball, and then later in club rugby. Now I'm kind of a weekend warrior tennis player. I'm not very good, but I'm trying to be. I love community. I love building that with our team and with my wife and I and our family. And yeah, that's a big part. And I think a big drive for me is learning. I think it's why there's an autonomy of being able to have an agency that's small and boutique, and we're trying to be really high output, high quality. But I think it's all about learning. You're just always testing and learning something new, which is a big part of my reason for doing what I do.
Yeah. So my question is, how does a cowboy become a performance marketing guy? What was the switch?
I love being outdoors. My parents really craved the horse way of life. And I think there's a lot of external things you look at and go, wow, it's romantic, it's cool, how do you get to do that? But they craved it in a way that was so far, beyond my sister and I. I think a funny thing happened where, I'd be watching, commercials as a kid and just enamored with the combination of art and science that went into reaching an audience and kind of making people connect. You look at what Nike did in the early 90s. You look at what just brands could do to TV being the primary medium. So, since I'm a little older, the internet wasn't there until my senior year of high school. It captured my imagination. So when I went off to college, communication was my major. I ended up going into history because I didn't want to have too many majors. And it just captured me even more. But I think there's some connection there where how do you connect with data, psychology, brand, the human aspects, entertainment, the things that have come up now with memes are similar for me now. And I think that I was very fascinated by those intersection of things, and so it took me a while to kind of fully get into that. And I feel like now I get to do that with a really a fun group of people, and that's hard to really, it's hard to beat. It's a pretty enjoyable way to work, and I enjoy making sure the team is has what they need too.
Yeah. So would you say that cowboy life is a solitary life, or is it a social life usually?
I think that's a great question. I think most of the time it's associated with quite a bit of a solitary life, you know, and I think that depends. You know, if you've got a crew and you're herding cattle, you that crew is your social life. If you're going to shows to compete, that community and is your social life. You know, I have a big family friend influence in the roping world. You have a team, your two-man team or two-woman team of roping. A barrel racer might be more solitary, maybe like a tennis player. So it depends on the use, but I think general perception is you're kind of the Marlboro man by yourself with cattle and a horse out in the range, right?
So I mean, I'm listening to you because I heard you mention that as a kid you were watching TV, and then that connection, you know, the commercials and everything. So it almost sounds to me like, you know, having been in that world of solitary life as a cowboy, looking for that connection, and then you found that connection in marketing, right? I mean, that almost, I mean, was that a deliberate kind of, or it just kind of subliminally, it was driving you to, you know, this life is not where you're gonna find, but over here, this is what you want.
Yeah, I think it wasn't intentional necessarily, but I think, you know, my parents, you know, our family was so supportive and like kind of very fortunate, right? A combination of factors, you know, had a didn't have a lot of resource in some ways, in other ways we did. And then, you know, later on we were more fortunate. And I think like they were just always very supportive from the get-go to be like, really go after what you want to do. Get something you're passionate about and excited about. And they really emphasized that, my dad in particular. So I think that gave me the freedom from just who I was already, but also how I was being encouraged by my parents to pursue things that I thought were interesting, like history or like marketing or like aspects of how brands are connecting with people at that time in that medium. And so I think I was encouraged to explore cool things that really connected with me to do, as opposed to like, well, you got to kind of clock in and clock out, and that's it. You only have two options. You know, very, very 1% fortunate and grateful to have the access and the connections to good people and the schools and teachers and all that stuff that really kind of enabled that. We've got to even to go into work in the Bay Area at the time I did. It opened up so many doors, as you can tell. It's just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a show, old show, Two and a Half Men. I'm sure you've seen. So, you know, their relationship with their mother. And I remember this little exchange between one of the sons, I don't remember which one, and the mother. And the mother says, "But I love you." And of course, the son did something terrible. And then says, "But don't worry, I love you." And he goes, "Why do you love me? This I did such a bad. Oh, you're my son. I have to love you." So it's out of necessity. So the reason I tell this is because your parents are gonna support you. I mean, some parents fight you. I mean, I've seen enough of it myself, in myself as well as friends. But generally, parents support you. But what is curious to me is you sought after a life that right in the center has connection, even though what you were brought up to wrap yourself in is a solitary life. So that's something that was, you know, was clearly there for you to say, this is where I want to be. And of course, with parents' support, you got everything you wanted in terms of the kind of life you are looking for. So
Yeah,
that's good.
I will say like there's some aspects of solitary, but there's so much community to Especially the summer camp aspect and the friends and family I grew up with. So like, yeah, you're is kind of a funny, surprising progression that kind of came to be not by design, but by a number of factors, and like a lot of people. And but yeah, you can kind of see the themes of community and connecting throughout a lot of it.
Well, great conversation, both business and philosophical. So, Ty, tell us, how can people reach you? Give us your contact information.
Thank you so much, Nick. Best way is probably on LinkedIn, Ty DeGrange, CEO of Round Barn Labs. If you want to check out our website, you can, roundbarnlabs.com. And then I also am on Twitter a little bit here and there, and like to follow tech and D2C e-com and SaaS and some of the fun emerging stuff that's happening. So always love to have people reach out and say hi and ask for help, anything they can do to support. I'm here for it.
Yeah, great. I'm sure you will hear from people. Thank you, Ty. Great conversation. And thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Nick. Appreciate
Thank
it.
you. Before I go, a quick reminder to say goodbye to your cash flow problems and claim your extra $1,500 when you qualify for $25,000 or more in funding. Go to www.runviably.com/legends and start your application today. And this brings us to the end of another episode, and I'll see you on next.
If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the episode, and share it with someone you think would benefit from it too.